Around this time, Rockefeller recruited to the Standard Legal staff Roger Sherman, who had masterminded the producer's case against him. For years a champion of Oil Creek, Sherman had fought valiantly to imprison Rockefeller. Now Rockefeller was wily enough to offer him a job. And Sherman was naive enough, or original enough, to accept it. Always proud of his persuasive powers, Rockefeller took special pleasure in wooing opponents whom he had learned to appreciate by tracking their ploys against him. When a lawyer named Virgil Klein won two lawsuits against him in the 1880s, Rockefeller invited him to his office. "Mr. Klein," he said, "you have given us a good licking. Now I would like to have you come and work for me." Klein agreed and became a long-standing member of the Standard Oil legal staff. Things worked out differently for Roger Sherman, who realized after a strangely inactive year on the payroll that Rockefeller had given him a 5-year contract expressly to neutralize him. When he tried to wriggle free of the contract, he was able only to strike a compromise that allowed him to resume his general practice in western Pennsylvania while remaining on retainer to Standard Oil. When he later returned to the crusade against Rockefeller, the independents were too disenchanted by his flirtation with Standard to deal with him. True to his wishes, Rockefeller had tarnished Sherman, separating him from his one-time admirers. Ever since his boyhood as the son of the town pariah, Rockefeller had evinced more than a trace of paranoia. Now, embattled in courts and legislative chambers, he was convinced that evildoers were plotting against him and complained to one colleague about this iniquitous proceeding of getting the United States out with a dragnet for the Standard Oil Company. As chief instigator of his misery, he cited George Rice, an independent refiner, who would pursue him with the tenacity of a harpy for decades. Rockefeller's movements in 1879 were governed largely by the need to duck subpoenas. In July, the New York State Assembly held hearings, chaired by Alonzo Barton Hepburn, to probe clandestine relations between the railroads and various industries. While the panel examined flour millers, meat packers, and salt makers, it zeroed in on Standard Oil as the most notorious beneficiary of backscratching with the railroads. That summer, Rockefeller stayed at Forest Hill, safely beyond the committee's reach. As was true of many exposés of Rockefeller, the Hepburn hearings fueled public indignation against him, while it also inadvertently enhanced his mystique as an invulnerable genius. The committee trotted out William H. Vanderbilt, who paid resounding tribute to the disciplined craft of the Standard Oil executives. "Long ago, I said if the thing kept on, the oil people would own the roads. These men are smarter than I am a great deal. They are very enterprising and smart men. I never came into contact with any class of men so smart and able as they are in their business." John D. Archbold's testimony previewed the manner, flippant, arrogant, glib, and high-handed, in which he disposed of future legal challenges to Standard Oil's authority. Asked about his functions as a director, Archbold retorted, "I am a clamorer for dividends. That is the only function I have in connection with the Standard Oil Company." He blatantly perjured himself when he said that Standard didn't control Acme Oil Company. When Chairman Hepburn asked him to return for further questioning the next day, Archbold dismissed the committee instead of the other way around. "I have given today to the matter," he told them. "It will be impossible for me to be with you again." For the most part, Standard officers dodged questions with the ritual evasion, "I refuse to answer on the advice of counsel." When the Hepburn report was issued, it lent credence to what might otherwise have seemed fantastic conjecture, documenting a pattern of pervasive railroad favoritism toward large shippers. The New York Central alone enforced 6,000 secret contracts, while the Erie's business was equally honeycombed with privileged arrangements. The committee assailed Standard Oil as a mysterious organization whose business and transactions are of such a character that its members decline giving a history or description of it, lest this testimony be used to convict them of a crime. For years, refiners had debated whether railroads were unregulated enterprises, free to strike what bargains they pleased, or common carriers committed to treat all alike. The Hepburn Report buttressed the latter view, saying that railroad bias toward Standard Oil was the most shameless perversion of the duties of a common carrier to private ends in the history of the world. To remedy this, the New York legislature set up a railroad commission to regulate rates in a fair, uniform manner. The Hepburn Report, however, was both belated and insufficient in hobbling Rockefeller's triumphant march. For by this time he had parlayed his secret railroad contracts into preeminence in oil. More important, his firm had now advanced far beyond the railroads to more efficient pipelines. In fact, a cynic might argue that the advent of the Hepburn hearings was incontestable proof that the railroads no longer mattered. The growing agitation over railway reform hardened Rockefeller's determination to bring the Tidewater pipeline to bay, and he began to harass his competitor with a bewildering array of challenges. He tried to throttle the pipeline's access to crude oil and explored the purchase of several New York refineries before they could become Tidewater clients. At one point, he reduced rates on Standard Oil pipelines while the railroads dropped prices to such risible levels that one freight agent said that they scarcely covered the wheel grease. This relentless price war forced Tidewater to operate at half capacity. It turned out that Rockefeller's adversary, Byron Benson, was no more enamored of free markets than Rockefeller was, and had created the pipeline to join in the feast. In March 1880, Daniel O'Day chanced to meet Benson on a train traveling from Oil City to Bradford, and was shocked by his rival's words. As O'Day reported to Rockefeller, "Benson told me that he wanted to let the bars down," as he expressed it, "for any overtures that might be made to his company with a view of an adjustment of the pipeline questions. He said that he felt that the time had about come when the companies should work together with a view of preventing other companies from engaging in the business." Benson's solution suited Rockefeller just fine. Tidewater, instead of cutting rates to compete with the railroads, would collude with them to raise rates. Thus, within a year of its completion, the pipeline that was supposed to emancipate independence from Standard Oil bondage was drawn into a railroad pool supervised by John D. Rockefeller. In 1882, when Byron Benson decided to borrow $2 million to expand Tidewater, it prompted vigorous opposition from a group of minority shareholders. Exploiting this dissension, parties friendly to Standard Oil bought the minority stake, enabling Rockefeller to strike a bargain with Tidewater the following year. Under this pact, Standard Oil divided the pipeline business in Pennsylvania, taking 88.5% of the trade and leaving just 11.5% to Tidewater. It was now abundantly clear to Rockefeller that the railroads represented a fading order. For a long time, he had resisted an irreversible shift to pipes, for fear of antagonizing the railroads, but this concern lost its force. When Standard Oil constructed four pipelines from western Pennsylvania to Cleveland, New York, Philadelphia, and Buffalo, he pressured the railroads to grant it right-of-way concessions, even though the pipelines signaled their doom. When Standard Oil subdued Tidewater, it again demoralized the independents and suggested that all opposition to the behemoth was a foolish, chimerical dream. While a band of intrepid reformers continued to joust with Standard Oil in courthouses and legislatures, most producers now surrendered hope of any improvement in their plight. They knew they would either have to quit the business or swallow their pride and make peace with the oil giant. With the passing of Tidewater's complete independence, they could no longer ship oil from Pennsylvania without paying tribute to the all-powerful Mr. Rockefeller. Chapter 13. Seat of Empire. When John D. Rockefeller turned 40 on July 8, 1879, he was already numbered among America's 20 richest men, yet he was likely the most obscure of the pantheon. While this resulted largely from his aversion to publicity, it also stemmed from his residing in Cleveland. As one chronicler said of the town, "Its rich folk were not scandalous or showy. Its politics had not the violent quality essential to American fame." In other words, it was an ideal place for a reclusive magnate. Throughout his career, Rockefeller pooh-poohed exaggerated press estimates of his wealth. yet they often underestimated his true worth. In the late 1870s, one newspaper pegged his wealth at more than $5 million, when his Standard Oil stock alone was by then worth $18 million, or $265 million in 1996 dollars. By comparison, when America's richest citizen, Commodore Vanderbilt, died in 1877, he left an estate valued at nearly $100 million. Photos of Rockefeller from this period show two contrasting faces. In his serious mode, his expression seemed grim and unsmiling, with tremendous force in his gaze, but no softness or joy. Yet when photographed in leisure hours in the sanctuary of Forest Hill, he looked trim and whimsical, surprisingly boyish for such a powerful man. Gone were the old side whiskers, but he still had a full red mustache and sandy brown hair. In a period when moguls prided themselves on their embonpoint, Rockefeller was as lean as a greyhound. And at a time when top hats and watch chains were de rigueur for any self-respecting plutocrat, Rockefeller generally conformed to the requisite style, but his family constantly had to remind him to buy a new suit when his current one got too shiny. If Rockefeller generally enjoyed excellent health, there were early warning symptoms of the toll taken by the excruciating pressures of Standard Oil. In 1878, he wrote to Eliza, "I am eating celery, which I understand to be very good for nervous difficulty." Colleagues plied him with advice to take more vacations and spend more time away from business, even though Rockefeller later said he was almost semi-retired at this point. He tried to spend as many afternoons as possible at Forest Hill in the bracing air of Lake Erie. He displayed a strong interest in herbal medicines and other folk remedies, advising one associate that he could dispense more easily with tobacco if he had an orange peel before breakfast every day. Big Bill's interest in medicine, conventional and otherwise, began to surface in his son and became more pronounced with time. Now that Rockefeller headed almost all of America's oil refineries and pipelines, the press belatedly awakened to his existence, acknowledging him as a new deity in the industrial firmament. In November 1878, he sat for his first full-length newspaper profile in the New York Sun. The article disclosed the scope of an ambition that Rockefeller took pains to deny. "The people of Cleveland say that it is his ambition to become the richest man in Ohio and one of the 10 richest men in the United States. He is in a fair way of being able to count on his fingers the men in the country who are richer than he is." This first sketch, which portrayed him as quiet, reserved, and methodical, was shot through with ambivalence. Of Rockefeller's business ability, the reporter rhapsodized, "Businessmen in Cleveland, in the oil regions, and in New York who know him or know of him, regard him as one of the great commercial intellects of the country." Yet the article concluded that his Olympian success arose from a strange, unsavory bargain with the railroads, a pact that people surmised but could never quite prove. Within a year, the Hepburn hearings began to document what had long been mooted about Rockefeller's dealings with the railroads, and by the early 1880s he had moved a considerable distance from his former anonymity to something closer to universal notoriety. In late 1883, Rockefeller's life assumed a marginally higher profile when he moved to New York. 1884 would prove to be a pivotal year for the country, marked by bank failures and panics, and the demise of General Grant's brokerage firm, Grant & Ward. The Democratic reformer Grover Cleveland triumphed in the presidential election over the corrupt Republican candidate James G. Blaine, installing a Democrat in the White House for the first time in many years. Rockefeller had long felt the gravitational pull of New York, with its lively export trade in kerosene, and routinely spent part of each winter there. Haunted by his father's wanderings, he was loath to abandon Setti and the children, and for two winters in the mid-1870s, he lodged them at the Windsor Hotel on Fifth Avenue, where Jay Gould often plotted his corporate raids. From 1877 to 1884, Rockefeller and his family stayed at the Buckingham Hotel, a residential hotel on Fifth Avenue, on the present site of the Saks department store. They had a large suite of rooms in the shadow of St. Patrick's Cathedral, whose huge stained glass windows loomed up dreamily outside their windows at night. One of Junior's early memories was of being reprimanded sharply by his mother for failing to thank a hotel waiter for bringing him food. After Harvey Spellman's death in 1881, Grandmother Spellman and Aunt Lou took a suite on the same floor and shared meals with them. From late spring through early fall, the entourage returned to Forest Hill, where Rockefeller stayed in touch with the New York office by sophisticated telegraphy. Business now dictated Rockefeller's move to the East Coast. In an age of long-distance pipelines, huge volumes of crude oil were flowing to seaboard refineries where they fed a flourishing export traffic, relegating Cleveland and other inland centers to an inferior status. Responding to the export boom, Standard Oil established sprawling refineries in Brooklyn, Bayonne, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. A latent tension now strained relations between the Cleveland headquarters and its burgeoning New York branch. One day, Benjamin Brewster, a Standard director, told Rockefeller that a two-headed calf belonged only in the circus and that the combine needed a single head. "You can't have one head in Cleveland and another in New York," he told Rockefeller, "and therefore either you have got to quit Cleveland and come on here, or we've got to pack up and leave New York and go out to Cleveland." By the time Rockefeller and Oliver Payne transferred to New York in late 1883 and early 1884, Henry Flagler had preceded them by 2 years. Though now immensely rich, John and Setti possessed the low-key style and resolute sense of privacy of old money and searched for a house on a peaceful side street. They swapped 9 parcels of Manhattan real estate, appraised at $600,000, for a 4-story brownstone mansion at 4 West 54th Street. Garlanded with ivy, flanked by lawns, the residence stood on a site that would later house the Museum of Modern Art Sculpture Garden. If roomy and comfortable, it was extremely modest for someone of Rockefeller's wealth, and, like his Cleveland residence, subtly masked the size of his fortune. For all its social cachet, Fifth Avenue was now a busy, nerve-jangling thoroughfare, as Junior remembered with dismay. "It was paved with cobblestones, and I can still hear the noise of the steel tires rumbling along the street. It was fearfully noisy." By contrast, West 54th Street was a shady retreat situated north of the Elgin Botanical Gardens, which later formed part of Rockefeller Center. Opposite the Rockefeller home stood St. Luke's Hospital, with lawns and gardens that spread a fragrant tranquility over the street. The home that the Rockefellers bought was the opulent boudoir of the beautiful Arabella Worsham, who had tried to pass herself off as a niece of railroad mogul Collis Huntington when she was actually his mistress. When Huntington's wife died in late 1883, he decided to marry Arabella and make an honest woman of her. The sober brownstone that had sheltered their assignations went on the market, and it is amusing to think of the Rockefellers snapping up their love nest. A frugal man, John D. followed his accustomed practice of keeping the furnishings, even if the style in this case diverged ludicrously from his own. The interior contained touches of voluptuous sensuality, such as Arabella's exotic Moorish salon on the ground floor and the Turkish bath upstairs. The sumptuous master bedroom was artistically designed in Anglo-Japanese style, with dark ebonized woodwork, a queen-size canopied sleigh bed, and a magnificent silver and gilt chandelier. The bay window provided an intimate Turkish corner, tantalizingly glimpsed through a stained glass screen. Doubtless as a legacy of Arabella Worsham, one can picture the prudish Rockefellers shopping for such things. 4 West 54th Street had paintings by Corot, Meissonier, d'Aubigny, and other French painters then in vogue among local parvenus. The house also had the latest conveniences, including one of the city's first elevators in a private residence. The only thing removed by Rockefeller were the worn carpets, which he donated to the needy through a local church. Though West 54th Street was a tree-lined oasis, the Rockefellers had chosen the most sybaritic precinct of New York society in the Gilded Age. Much of the wealth amassed in what Mark Twain called the raging, tearing, booming 19th century had now settled in Manhattan. The old New York aristocracy, huddled around Washington Square and Gramercy Park, shuddered at the pretentious uptown mansions which paid tribute to post-war fortunes in railroads, steel, and oil. Along Fifth Avenue, near the Rockefeller home, the palaces of the rich, notably the fantastic turreted confections of William K. Vanderbilt at 51st Street and Cornelius Vanderbilt II at 58th Street, stretched uptown in gaudy profusion. With Standard Oil moving its headquarters to New York, the neighborhood was becoming a colony of company directors. At one point in this corporate relocation, 28 Standard Oil executives arrived in a single Pullman car from Cleveland and were taken straight to the St. James Hotel, where William presided over their first breakfast and John their first dinner. The latter liked to greet new arrivals at the train station and help them to find houses. Soon, the Fifth Avenue strip near Rockefeller's home was thickly populated with Standard Oil men, Henry Flagler occupying the southeast corner of 54th Street, and William Rockefeller the northeast corner, with Benjamin Brewster next door to William. William departed from his brother's ascetic style and raised his children in a looser, freer atmosphere, causing envious pangs among John's children. As Junior said, "We children didn't have what those children had, and we used to notice the difference. They had a gay kind of social life, with many parties which we used to wish we could have." Since William refused to take on debt to build his house, he sold $50,000 of Standard Oil stock to John, despite his brother's heartfelt plea to retain the stock. William's imprudent decision figured importantly in the enormous disparity in wealth that developed between the two brothers. In New York, John D. did not acquire cosmopolitan interests, but stuck with his old Cleveland pastimes, creating a large ice skating rink every winter in a space adjoining his house. Each morning, curious pedestrians could glimpse the chief of the American oil industry, dressed in overcoat and top hat, ice skates strapped to his patent leather boots, as he glided placidly around the horseshoe-shaped area. A great enthusiast for the sport, he created rows of shelves in his house on which dozens of guests could store their skates. Though Rockefeller resisted the yacht-owning fad that swept New York society in the 1880s and owned neither a boat nor private railroad car, he spared no expense for fast-trotting horses in his large heated stable at 21 West 55th Street. Every afternoon after work, he took out his black gelding trotters and mingled with the pageant of fashionable carriages thronging Central Park, often racing against his brother William, with an excited junior seated at his side. So keenly did Rockefeller relish trotting that at one point he told his son, "I drove 4 times yesterday, making an aggregate in the 2 days of about 80 miles. Don't you think I am an enthusiastic youth?" Junior left a description of his father's racing style that seems a metaphor for his assertive but careful stewardship of Standard Oil. Other drivers would often lose their tempers when a horse broke gate or pulled hard. Father never. If a horse was excitable or difficult, he always kept his temper and patiently, quietly worked with the animal until he steadied it. Frequently, I have seen him driving at a very rapid pace through Central Park, in the middle of the roadway through 2 streams of traffic, pushing always a little to the left, as he explained to me, so as to open his way through, but keeping margin enough on the right so that if the approaching traffic did not swing over in time, he would still have room enough to pass. Never dazzled by New York, Rockefeller was insulated from the beau monde that threw costly dinners and costume balls and frequented the theater, opera, and clubs. He had no interest in debauchery, and it is hard to picture him milling about with portly men smoking cigars or women wearing expensive furs and jewels. The newspapers noted his total boycott of social functions. As one periodical said, "He never entertains notables, his home is never given to entertainment, and he follows the policy of self-effacement at all times and in all places." Although he joined the Union League Club, Rockefeller did not feel comfortable with the splendor of the Astors and Vanderbilts. When Setti asked for a new four-wheeled carriage in 1882, John stared at her, aghast, and said they could scarcely afford it unless they traded in the old one. Abiding by his daily rituals, he still enjoyed bread and milk in the morning and a paper bag of apples in the evening. Each morning before work, a barber shaved him in his dressing room before he trotted down the brownstone stoop at exactly the same hour, and for a nickel took the Sixth Avenue elevated train downtown. The wheels of his mind already turning, he jotted penciled notes on his shirt cuff as the train jolted toward Wall Street. Moving with spectral stealth, as if tiptoeing on a cushion of air, he slipped into the Standard Oil Building at the stroke of 9. "I never knew anyone to enter an office as quietly as Mr. Rockefeller," said his private secretary, George Rogers. He seemed almost to have a coat of invisibility. In late 1883, Standard Oil began to assemble real estate at the southern tip of Manhattan for new headquarters, destined to soar above Broadway at Bowling Green on the one-time site of Alexander Hamilton's home. Having long outgrown William's old offices at two different locations on Pearl Street, the firm had operated for 3 years from modest, unprepossessing quarters at 44 Broadway. Now, on May 1, 1885, after spending nearly $1 million on it, Standard Oil moved into its impregnable new fortress, a massive granite 9-story building. The combine's name didn't appear outside, just the building number. 26 Broadway soon became the world's most famous business address, shorthand for the oil trust itself, evoking its mystery, power, and efficiency. Standard Oil was now America's premier business, with a reach that ramified into a labyrinth of railroads, banks, and other businesses. The purple prose aroused by the new building perhaps owed less to its imposing neoclassical architecture than to its symbolic heft, said one reporter. "Many worthy men are convinced that number 26 Broadway is the most perilous shelter on earth, a cave for pirates, a den for the cutthroats of commerce." Otherwise sober writers seemed to swoon before the saturnine grandeur of Rockefeller's seat of power. At the lower end of the greatest thoroughfare in the greatest city of the New World is a huge structure of plain gray stone. Solid as a prison, towering as a steeple, its cold and forbidding facade seems to rebuke the heedless levity of the passing crowd and frown on the frivolity of the stray sunbeams which in the late afternoon play around its impassive cornices. Men point to its stern portals, glance quickly up at the rows of unwinking windows, nudge each other and hurry onward, as the Spaniards used to do when going by the offices of the Inquisition. The building is number 26 Broadway. Reporters who managed to slip past the watchful guards found a world at odds with the grim exterior. A dignified place with mahogany roll-top desks and mustard-colored carpets. The subdued atmosphere, people instinctively conferred in hushed tones, mirrored Rockefeller's own personality. Rockefeller's office faced south and east, with a spectacular view of New York Harbor. As one reporter commented, "There is an absence of bustle and noise. While transactions involving millions may be involved, the negotiations are conducted in a quiet, methodical manner, apparently free from excitement." The offices had some unusual security features, including ground glass partitions that reached to the ceiling and obscured the proceedings within. In a quintessential Rockefeller touch, the doors were equipped with special secret rim locks. One had to know how to twist the rim with thumb and forefinger before turning the knob, so that an intruder could find himself suddenly trapped in a maze of ostensibly locked doors. In these new quarters, the Standard Oil Mandarins preserved a tradition launched years before. Each day at noon, the executive committee gathered for lunch in a top-floor room decorated with hunting and fishing trophies, and with a port view that suited their global empire. There was no surer proof of favor in the Standard Oil Empyrean than to receive an invitation to dine at the long table. Arriving in silk hats, frock coats, and gloves, the directors always took the same assigned seats. In his deceptively self-effacing style, Rockefeller yielded the head of the table to his most frequent adversary, Charles Pratt, who was the group's oldest member. Flagler sat to Pratt's right, then Rockefeller, then Archbold. It says much about his managerial approach that Rockefeller sat indistinguishably among his colleagues, though the leveling arrangement scarcely disguised his unique status. As philosopher Herbert Spencer once said, "A business partnership, balanced as the authorities of its members may theoretically be, presently becomes a union in which the authority of one partner is tacitly recognized as greater than that of the other or others." Few outsiders knew that one of Rockefeller's greatest talents was to manage and motivate his diverse associates. As he said, "It is chiefly to my confidence in men and my ability to inspire their confidence in me that I owe my success in life." He liked to note that Napoleon could not have succeeded without his marshals. Free of an aristocratic temperament, Rockefeller was quick to delegate authority and presided lightly, genially over his empire, exerting his will in unseen ways. At meetings, Rockefeller had a negative capability. The quieter he was, the more forceful his presence seemed, and he played on his mystique as the resident genius immune to petty concerns. As one director recalled, "I have seen board meetings when excited men shouted profanity and made menacing gestures, but Mr. Rockefeller, maintaining the utmost courtesy, continued to dominate the room. Sometimes he dozed on a couch after lunch. I can see him now," one executive recalled, "lying back on a lounge at a director's meeting, eyes closed, taking it all in. Now and then he'd open his eyes and make a suggestion." Rockefeller placed a premium on internal harmony and tried to reconcile his contending chieftains. A laconic man, he liked to canvass everyone's opinion before expressing his own, and then often crafted a compromise to maintain cohesion. He was always careful to couch his decisions as suggestions or questions. Even in the early days, he had lunched daily with Brother William, Harkness, Flagler, and Payne to thrash out problems. As the organization grew, he continued to operate by consensus, taking no major initiative opposed by board members. Because all ideas had to meet the supreme test of unanimous approval among strong-minded men, Standard Oil made few major missteps. As Rockefeller said, "We made sure that we were right and had planned for every contingency before we went ahead." Even though Rockefeller feuded sporadically with Charles Pratt, Henry Rogers, and others, the firm was free of the petulant bickering and bureaucratic jealousy that usually accompany vast power. At least to hear Rockefeller tell it, the directors, former foes who had banded together in corporate brotherhood, were bound by an almost mystic faith. For him, their belief in each other explained their cohesion and certified their virtue. "Crooked men cannot be held as these Standard Oil Company men are held for all this long term." The continuity of leadership made the firm all but impervious to snooping reporters and government investigators, who could never penetrate the tight-knit phalanx of like-minded men who ran the oil empire for four consecutive decades. The unity of the Standard Oil partners was especially impressive given the organization's Byzantine structure, a far-flung patchwork of firms, each nominally independent but in reality taking orders from 26 Broadway. In the absence of a federal incorporation law, Rockefeller, like other contemporary businessmen, had to cope with a tangle of restrictive laws that made it fiendishly difficult to run an interstate company. As he said, "Our federal form of government, making every corporation created by a state foreign to every other state, renders it necessary for persons doing business through corporate agency to organize corporations in some or many of the different states in which their business is located." This handicap forced business leaders to devise cunning ways to circumvent laws and led them to corrupt politicians and legislatures. Much of Rockefeller's political cynicism issued from this source. For Standard Oil, a national operation from the start, the antiquated legal framework lured it into myriad legal adaptations. But if Rockefeller correctly considered the legal system an unfair impediment, it was also a spur to his ingenuity. His first major improvisation came with an ingenious trust agreement that was executed privately in 1879. Under its charter, Standard Oil of Ohio couldn't own companies outside the state, so it assigned three mid-level employees, Myron R. Keith, George F. Chester, and George H. Vilas, to serve as trustees, who held stock in a score of subsidiaries outside the state. When they received dividends, they distributed them to the 37 investors of Standard of Ohio as individuals, in amounts proportionate to their stakes in the parent company. Of the 35,000 Standard shares, Rockefeller held nearly 9,000, or three times the amount of Flagler, Harkness, Pratt, or Payne. This jerry-built structure enabled Rockefeller to swear under oath that Standard Oil of Ohio didn't own property outside of Ohio, even though it controlled most of the pipelines and refineries in Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and Maryland. Technically speaking, the trustees owned these properties. The 1879 agreement, a makeshift arrangement, lasted only 3 years. When the state of Pennsylvania tried in 1881 to tax the property of Standard of Ohio within its borders, Rockefeller feared that other states might copy this precedent and hold him hostage. At the same time, he had absorbed so many new pipelines and refineries that he was struggling to coordinate policy among many scattered units. The time had come to streamline operations, impose guidance, and attain new efficiencies. The brains behind this next stage of development was an affable, roly-poly lawyer and Presbyterian elder named Samuel C. T. Dodd, a man so fat that one wag claimed he was the same size in every direction. As general solicitor of Standard Oil from 1881 to 1905, he was its leading theoretician and publicist, as much ideologist as lawyer. A carpenter's son from Franklin, Pennsylvania, and an amateur poet passionate about classical literature, he had been a vocal, high-minded resident of Titusville. Ironically, as a Democratic member of Pennsylvania's Constitutional Convention in 1872, Dodd had won attention as the scourge of the railroads, excoriating Rockefeller and the South Improvement Company for taking advantage of rebates. The way Dodd entered Standard Oil should have tipped him off to the depth of Rockefeller's guile. In 1878, two refiners named Taylor and Satterfield hired him in a dispute against Union Pipelines, which was ostensibly owned by Vandergrift and Foreman. Since Dodd was also a lawyer for Captain Jacob J. Vandergrift, he found himself representing both sides in the case. At one point, Vandergrift made a shocking confession to him. United Pipelines actually belonged lock, stock, and barrel to Standard Oil. At the behest of his clients, Dodd journeyed to Cleveland to draw up a mutually satisfactory settlement. As he recalled, "Here for the first time I met John D. Rockefeller, a very pleasant, gentlemanly, unassuming man, but slow in his deliberations and particular as possible at every point of negotiation. Being a little vexed one day at my objection to some clause he desired in the contract which was being drawn, he said in a sarcastic tone, 'Mr. Dodd, do you often act for both sides in a case?' I said, 'Not often, Mr. Rockefeller, but I am always ready to do so when both sides want an honest lawyer.' This seemed to amuse him, and we soon brought the matter to a settlement." When Rockefeller hired him in 1879, Dodd held out, not for more money or titles, but for assurances of his integrity. Taking a relatively small salary, it would never exceed $25,000 a year, he resisted Rockefeller's plea that he take Standard Oil stock, arguing that this might compromise his legal judgment, and he never became a Standard director for that reason. He also emphasized that he would never alter his settled views on the injustice of railroad rebates. To all these conditions, Rockefeller assented breezily, perhaps too breezily. As will be seen, he spent years fooling Dodd about Standard Oil's relations with the railroads, to the point that one must conclude that Dodd fairly asked to be duped and suspended all skepticism. After being hired by Rockefeller, Dodd was ostracized by many former clients along Oil Creek. To these critics, he shrugged and said, "Well, as the ministers say when they get a call to a higher salary, it seems to be the Lord's will." Rockefeller bestowed this encomium on Dodd. A more just man never lived. He was a lovable, loyal man. In many antitrust hearings, Rockefeller looked to the redoubtable Dodd and awaited his nod of approval before answering questions. Dodd was a wizard at contriving forms that obeyed the letter but circumvented the spirit of the law. As the Keith Chester Vilas travesty became known, Dodd studied new organizational structures that might allow Standard to expand business while maintaining centralized control. That the major directors lived in separate cities, mostly Cleveland, New York, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, was impeding finely meshed coordination. Dodd came up with a sudden brainstorm as to how to meld intrastate firms into an interstate giant. The first step was to set up a separate Standard Oil Company in each state in which it had major interests. As a result, Standard Oil of New York was formed on August 1, 1882, with William Rockefeller as president. 4 days later, John became president of the new Standard Oil of New Jersey. This stratagem was designed to prevent each state from taxing Standard Oil property located outside the state. Dodd realized that separate companies required separate boards of directors and considered how to prevent a fragmentation of power. The answer, he explained, was that you could have a common name, a common office, and a common management by means of a common executive committee. The stock could in effect be made common by placing the corporate stock in the hands of trustees who shall issue certificates of interest in the trust estate, which certificates will be entitled to their due proportions of the various stock dividends. As Dodd noted, this elaborate stock swap would create a union not of corporations but of stockholders, ensuring that the companies could behave in concert without running afoul of the law. Dodd and Flagler drafted the new Standard Oil Trust Agreement, which was dated January 2, 1882. The public knew nothing of this contrivance that spawned a $70 million enterprise and controlled 90% of American refineries and pipelines, until it emerged accidentally in antitrust hearings 6 years later. The agreement created a board of 9 New York-based trustees, the group that assembled daily for lunch at 26 Broadway. Today we would term it a holding company, but at the time it seemed an imaginary entity lacking any real legal existence. It couldn't make deals, sign contracts, or keep books, though it wielded infinite power. It received the stock of Standard of Ohio and 40 other companies, 26 of them partially, 14 fully owned, with the power to name their officers and directors. Among the shareholders, the distribution of power and wealth remained lopsided, with Rockefeller holding more than one-third of the trust certificates, a block worth $19 million. The 5 members of the Cleveland wing, John and William Rockefeller, Flagler, Payne, and Harkness, retained a commanding majority of shares, and formed a pool within the top echelon to buy and sell jointly interests in other companies. For the first time, the trust's formation created negotiable securities, and this profoundly affected the Standard Oil culture. Not only did Rockefeller urge underlings to take stock, but made money abundantly available to do so. As such shareholding became widespread, it welded the organization more tightly together, creating an esprit de corps that helped in steamrolling over competitors and government investigators alike. With employees receiving huge capital gains and dividends, they converted Standard Oil into a holy crusade. Rockefeller hoped the trust would serve as a model for a new populist capitalism marked by employee share ownership. "I would have every man a capitalist, every man, woman, and child," he said. "I would have everyone save his earnings, not squander it, own the industries, own the railroads, own the telegraph lines." In many ways, Standard Oil's metamorphosis previewed the trajectory of other major American business organizations in the late 19th century, as they moved from freewheeling competition to loosely knit cartels to airtight trusts. The 1882 agreement introduced the concept of the trust as something synonymous with industrial monopoly. During the 1880s, industry-wide pools sprouted in many industries in America, England, and Germany, but their leaders found it difficult to prevent cheating and secret price-cutting among members. Now, Standard Oil came up with a way to introduce centralized control backed by enforcement powers and managerial direction. So many companies duplicated the pattern over the years that one can say, with pardonable exaggeration, that the 1882 trust agreement executed by Standard Oil led straight to the Sherman Antitrust Act 8 years later. Rockefeller was a unique hybrid in American business, both the instinctive first-generation entrepreneur who founds a company and the analytic second-generation manager who extends and develops it. He wasn't the sort of rugged self-made mogul who quickly becomes irrelevant to his own organization. For that reason, his career anticipates the managerial capitalism of the 20th century. Since he never owned more than a third of his company, he needed the cooperation of other people. Having created an empire of unfathomable complexity, he was smart enough to see that he had to submerge his identity in the organization. Many people noted that Rockefeller seldom said "I," except when telling a joke, preferring the first-person plural when discussing Standard Oil. "Don't say that I ought to do this or that," he preached to colleagues. "We ought to do it. Never forget that we are partners. Whatever is done is for the general good of us all." He preferred outspoken colleagues to weak-kneed sycophants and welcomed differences of opinion so long as they weren't personalized. In their private deliberations, the Standard executives, for all their swashbuckling reputation, tended to be cordial and formal. As Cleveland Amory said of them, "No group of American tycoons were ever more forbidding or high and mighty publicly, or more gentle and shy and retiring privately." By creating new industrial forms, Rockefeller left his stamp on an age that lauded inventors, not administrators. That he created one of the first multinational corporations, selling kerosene around the world and setting a business pattern for the next century, was arguably his greatest feat. As he said, "Our nation was in a state of transition from agriculture to wholesale manufacture and commerce, and we had to invent methods and machinery as we went along." Whatever the debates about his ethics, economists and historians have unanimously extolled his role as a pioneer of the modern corporation. Despite the legal impediments, he was able to fuse together dozens of disparate firms into a seamless whole. What might have been a cumbersome apparatus developed into an efficient instrument in Rockefeller's hands. Standard Oil led the way in industrial planning and large-volume production, exploiting economies of scale that might otherwise have been hard to achieve at this stage in a purely competitive state. Under Rockefeller's tutelage, the trust made notable strides in improving kerosene, developing byproducts, and reducing the cost of packaging, transporting, and distributing petroleum products worldwide. As one biographer has remarked, "Rockefeller must be accepted as the greatest business administrator America has produced." An oil historian echoes this verdict. "Rockefeller was the single most important figure in shaping the oil industry. The same might arguably be said for his place in the history of America's industrial development and the rise of the modern corporation." The secret to unifying the dozens of affiliated concerns proved to be the committee system patented by Standard Oil. The inner sanctum was the executive committee. Though they recommended actions to field supervisors, they held considerable power in reserve, for they had to approve all expenditures above $5,000 and salary increases above $50 a month, enabling them to retard the growth of any unit. Below the executive committee came a battery of specialized committees dedicated to transportation, pipelines, domestic trade, export trade, manufacturing, purchasing, and so on. These committees standardized the quality of subsidiaries engaged in similar work, enabling managers to swap insights and align their operations. As Rockefeller said of this innovation, "A company of men, for example, were specialists in manufacture. These were chosen experts who had daily sessions and study of the problems, new as well as old, constantly arising. The benefit of their research, their study, was available for each of the different concerns whose shares were held by these trustees. Under the committee system, Standard Oil created a self-sufficient universe, overseeing plants that made acid, chemicals, staves, barrels, wicks, pumps, and even tank cars. It shut down more than 30 obsolete refineries, concentrating more than a quarter of world kerosene production in three monster plants in Cleveland, Bayonne, and Philadelphia. The committee system was an ingenious adaptation, integrating the policy of constituent companies without stripping them of all autonomy. We must recall that Standard Oil remained a confederation and most of its subsidiaries were only partially owned. A top-down hierarchical structure might have hampered local owners whom Rockefeller had promised a measure of autonomy in running their plants. The committee system galvanized their energies while providing them with general guidance. The committees encouraged rivalry among local units by circulating performance figures and encouraging them to compete for records and prizes. The point is vitally important, for monopolies, spared the rod of competition, can easily lapse into sluggish giants. At Standard Oil, in contrast, as Rockefeller stated, the stimulus to make the best showing, each concern for itself, led to active and aggressive work in competition. For many years, Rockefeller had tried to free himself from details and applauded the committee system as relegating him to a fifth wheel. He never attended individual committee meetings, but sometimes, in his odd way, dropped by when committee heads conferred. As one member said, "I have seen Mr. Rockefeller often at a meeting of the heads of the different departments of the company, listening carefully to each one and not saying a word. Perhaps he would stretch out on a lounge and say, 'I am a little tired, but go right on, gentlemen, for I know you want to reach a decision.' He might close his eyes now and then, but he never missed a point. He would go away without saying a word but goodbye. But next day when he came down, he had digested the whole proposition and worked out the answer. And he always worked out the right answer." Although Standard Oil encouraged cooperation and allowed strong executives to flourish, Rockefeller retained unrivaled influence. While colleagues embarked on shopping binges to buy palatial homes and European art, Rockefeller husbanded his money. He believed in Standard Oil and gladly purchased all available stock from other directors. "Oh, I was the dumping ground for them all in those days," he once laughed, and his unequaled shareholding gave his opinions extra weight. Beyond the size of his stake, Rockefeller also possessed an unlikely charisma. He never backslapped, roughhoused, or skylarked with his colleagues, and his statesmanlike calm evoked feelings of awe. As one reporter said in 1905, "No man, however unimpressionable he may be, can stand in the presence of Mr. Rockefeller without feeling the repressed power of the man." He seemed to possess oracular powers. As Archbold conceded, "Rockefeller always sees a little further than the rest of us, and then he sees around the corner." Another Standard executive, Edward T. Bedford, paid him this high tribute. "Mr. Rockefeller was really a superman. He not only envisaged a new system of business upon a grand scale, but he also had the patience, the courage, and the audacity to put it into effect in the face of almost insuperable difficulties, sticking to his purpose with a tenacity and confidence that were simply amazing." He also had a tactful, easy manner with less exalted employees and never reacted angrily when presented with grievances. Once a year, each employee had the right to appear before the executive committee and argue for a higher salary, and Rockefeller always reacted pleasantly. As one employee recalled, "When H.H. Rogers would say gruffly that he had had enough and we had no right to ask for an increase of salary, Mr. Rockefeller would say, 'Oh, give him a chance.'" But the mildness was deceiving, for while Rockefeller might sometimes be prepared to pay wages 10 or even 20% above the prevailing levels, he would never countenance unions or organized employee protest. In the last analysis, Rockefeller prevailed at Standard Oil because he had mastered a method for solving problems that carried him far beyond his native endowment. He believed there was a time to think and then a time to act. He brooded over problems and quietly matured plans over extended periods. Once he had made up his mind, however, he was no longer troubled by doubts and pursued his vision with undeviating faith. Unfortunately, once in that state of mind, he was all but deaf to criticism. He was like a projectile that, once launched, could never be stopped, never recalled, never diverted. Amid the murky temptations of Manhattan, the Rockefeller home was a tranquil island of missionary work, temperance meetings, and prayer vigils. Beset by fears of big city vice and determined to avoid exposure to liquor, cards, tobacco, and dancing, the Rockefellers still socialized only with kindred spirits. The greater the controversy surrounding Standard Oil, the more decorous their home life. The family belied John Wesley's dictum that wherever riches have increased, the essence of religion has decreased in the same proportion. The Rockefellers had also figured out how to solve the riddle that John Adams posed to Thomas Jefferson in 1819. Will you tell me how to prevent riches from producing luxury? Will you tell me how to prevent luxury from producing effeminacy, intoxication, extravagance, vice, and folly? The fear that wealth would adulterate their values only pushed John and Seti deeper into church activism and the temperance movement. In 1883, John sat on an advisory committee of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was campaigning for an amendment to the Ohio Constitution to outlaw the manufacture and sale of liquor. Though the initiative petered out, he later became a major benefactor of the Ohio Anti-Saloon League and grew steadily more militant in the cause. "I fear unless a great temperance reform sweeps over our whole land, the Republic itself may be imperiled," he thundered. Among other pet causes of this period, he gave substantial sums to the revivalist Dwight L. Moody and urged Henry Flagler to follow suit. Right before the Rockefellers left Cleveland, some friends asked Seti why her children hadn't been baptized, and she was haunted by the question. She began intensive prayer meetings with her children, which led to three of the four, Alta, 12, Edith, 11, and John, 9, to be baptized jointly on October 28, 1883, the last Sunday before their move to New York. Afterwards, Seti recorded her impressions. "It was a beautiful and impressive sight. After the morning service, there were plants and flowers around the baptistry, and a dove suspended over it." Since the Rockefellers returned to Cleveland each summer, John and Seti retained their positions at the Euclid Avenue Baptist Church. Upon arriving in Manhattan, they joined the Fifth Avenue Baptist Church and imported the Reverend William H. P. Faunce from Springfield, Massachusetts, to head it. It never occurred to the Rockefellers to trade up to a more socially prestigious denomination. Most Americans, when they accumulate money, climb the golden spires of the nearest Episcopal church, H. L. Mencken later observed. But the Rockefellers cling to the primeval rain god of the American hinterland and show no signs of being ashamed of him. They would not have felt comfortable with the splendor and formality of a high church denomination. After having been taught at home for many years, the Rockefeller children began to venture forth tentatively from their often stifling family cocoon. Rockefeller said he educated his children at home because he had divided his time between Cleveland and New York for several years, but he also might have wanted to sequester them from forbidden contacts. Bessie, Alta, and Edith now attended the Rye Female Seminary in Westchester County, directed by a Mrs. Life, the former Susan Lamont, who had tutored Rockefeller in his early adolescence in Owego. Though the progeny of one of America's richest men, the three young heiresses seemed to drift about in a state of perpetual longing, as one intimate companion recollected. "The allowances given to the children were small. Edith confided to me one day while we were shopping that it was the dearest wish of her heart to have some silk underwear, but that Mother wouldn't hear of it. Alta yearned for a high hat to wear with her riding costume, and when, after months of cajoling, she finally got it, she had a picture taken. Then the dream of her life became riding boots. Edith became positively clothes-crazy, displaying a craving for fashionable outfits and jewelry in defiance of her parents' values. By avoiding talk of money as unbecoming, Rockefeller concealed from his children the magnitude of his fortune. When Bessie enrolled at Vassar in the mid-1880s, she was the only daughter to attend college. She went on a shopping expedition with some classmates to purchase a Christmas present for a favorite teacher. At a Manhattan store, they found the perfect gift, a $100 desk. Since Bessie and her companions had only $75, they asked the merchant if he could wait a few days for the remaining $25. He agreed to do so if a New York businessman would vouch for them. "My father is in business," Bessie offered meekly. "He will vouch for us." "Who is your father?" asked the man. "His name is Mr. Rockefeller," she said. "John D. Rockefeller. He is in the oil business." The merchant gasped. "John D. Rockefeller, your father?" When he agreed to ship the furniture, Bessie imagined he had merely changed his mind to please them. When it came time for Junior to dispense with private tutors, he went to the New York School of Languages, followed by a school run by C.N. Douglas, and then the Tony Cutler School, whose student body included Albert Milbank, Cornelius N. Bliss, and Cornelius Vanderbilt. Junior trudged the pavement to school each morning while he watched poorer classmates rolling by in fine carriages. Though he belittled his own intelligence, this bright, dutiful boy always scored high grades and led a purposeful life that allowed small time for leisure. When not doing homework, he often practiced his violin, and for 8 years he took lessons from Richard Arnold, first violinist of the Philharmonic Orchestra. Though never spanked or punished, Junior had to put up with unremitting religious indoctrination from SETI. By comparison, Father was almost playful. Eager to please his parents and other adult authority figures, Junior took things too seriously and was petrified of making a mistake. It is a small miracle that, with so much duty so regularly dinned into their heads, the Rockefeller children didn't go batty. They did, however, erupt in a mass of psychosomatic symptoms. During his first year at Cutler, at age 13, Junior racked up a 98.1 grade average, only to succumb to some sort of nervous collapse from overwork. Too much expectation had been heaped on this frail vessel, and he buckled beneath the weight. His father ordered the staple Victorian cure of hard outdoors work. In late 1887, Junior and his mother wintered at Forest Hill, where he furiously chopped wood, 15 cents a cord, broke stones, burned brush, and raked leaves, working the nervous tension from his system. Junior enjoyed this fleeting monopoly on his mother's affections and the respite from his regimented New York life. His letters to his father evoke the melancholy beauty of a snowbound winter, with moonlit sleigh rides and afternoons skating on the frozen lake as he pushed SETI before him in a wooden chair. Reinvigorated by his stay, Junior completed a second year at Cutler before being transferred to a school custom-made for him. John and William Rockefeller conferred with a talented instructor, John A. Browning, who created the tiny Browning School, with just two classes, one built around Junior, the other around William's son, Percy. A Rockefeller operation from the outset, it was set up in a family-owned brownstone on West 55th Street, with John and William paying Browning's salary and reserving the right to screen applicants. From the beginning, the school emphasized manual crafts as well as classical studies and was animated by an egalitarian spirit. Nettie Fowler McCormick of the Chicago Reaper clan sent her two sons, Harold and Stanley, and the student body of 25 also included two sons of William's estate superintendent in Greenwich, Connecticut. The Browning School was yet another attempt by John D. to prevent his children from putting on airs or slipping into idle dissipation. The letters Junior sent his father from Forest Hill during the winter of 1887 to 1888 made clear that his mother was also recuperating from a bout of ill health. He told a friend, "Although it would be pleasant to be with the rest of the family, when we think how much good it is doing Mother, and she really is getting much better, she sleeps so well and feels so much better, we are perfectly happy to be separated." Always weak, Seti was beginning to betray signs of the frailty that would convert her into an invalid. She enjoyed driving with her husband and shared his love of skating, but took these activities only in small doses. "She was not strong and could not endure much exercise," said her son. For the biographer of John D. Rockefeller, the most exasperating lacuna in his story is Seti's transformation from a bright, witty girl into a rather humorless woman, prone to a nun-like religiosity. One wonders what happened to the high-spirited, vivacious young woman who was the high school valedictorian and literary editor at Oread Collegiate Institute. By the 1880s, when she was in her 40s, her letters were suffocated by a treacly piety and endless platitudes as she grew righteous and slightly